Hey everybody, before we get to today's episode, I wanted to share some really exciting news and express our gratitude at MWI for something that recently happened. Some of you might have noticed in your podcast app that the image associated with this podcast is a little bit different now. It mentions that the podcast is produced with the support of the West Point class of 1974. Now, for those of you who maybe aren't really familiar with West Point, collectively at the Academy, we really benefit from the generosity of alumni, or as they call them around here, old grads. In many cases, a particular year's graduating class will organize a gift to support the work of a specific organization at West Point or an initiative. 50 years ago this summer, on June 5th, 1974, more than 800 West Point cadets graduated and commissioned as officers. Members of the class went on to distinguish themselves both in and outside of the Army. And this year, as they celebrate 50 years since their graduation, the class has very generously chosen to support the work of the Modern War Institute, specifically with a gift that will allow us to continue producing our flagship podcast. The MWI podcast brings senior leaders, scholars, and other interesting guests, guests like General Charles Flynn, who you'll hear from today, onto the podcast to discuss the most vital issues related to modern war. And because of the generosity of the class of 1974, we're going to be able to keep doing that. We have some exceptional guests lined up in the future, so look out for episodes to come. And to the class of 1974, thank you so much for your support.
We campaign out here to deny key terrain, physical and human terrain, to our opponents. Humans have this unique tendency to live on land. Decisions are made on land. Nations exist and their wealth exists on land, and the land has to be protected, and we help them do that. We have more campaign streamers in the U.S. Army on our colors, on the Army colors, in this theater than all other theaters or all other wars combined.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast, brought to you with the very generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, editorial director at MWI, and on this episode, I'm joined by General Charles Flynn, the commanding general of U.S. Army Pacific. Now, many people look at a map of the Indo-Pacific region and assume it's a maritime environment, an air environment, where sea power and air power are most important. As General Flynn explains, however, the Army doesn't just play a major role there, which it does. It's more than that, though. Tied into what he calls the region's land power network, its activities there are crucial to U.S. objectives and the U.S. commitment to a free and secure Indo-Pacific. From assuring allies to deterring aggression, and from strengthening partnerships to introducing new and important capabilities, General Flynn's comments offer insights into the U.S. Army and its role in the Indo-Pacific. Before we get to the discussion, as always, a few quick notes. First, very special thanks to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. Second, be sure to subscribe to the MWI podcast on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. And lastly, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with General Charles Flynn. General Flynn, sir, I want to thank you for making some time for us today and say welcome to the MWI podcast.
Well, thanks, John. I appreciate you having me and look forward to the discussion and the questions.
Yes, sir. I'm also really looking forward to it. You are the commanding general of U.S. Army Pacific, and this is a region, the Indo-Pacific, that is not only really interesting, but one that's really important and that the United States is deeply committed to. So to sort of kick us off, I'd like to ask you how you, as the commanding general of U.S. Army Pacific, how you conceptualize the role of the U.S. Army in the region.
Yeah. Well, you know, contrary to popular belief, this region is often referred to as an air and maritime theater. And I remind people that it's actually a joint theater. It's got joint and multinational challenges, and it's only going to be solved by joint and multinational solutions, and we are part of the joint force. The region is made up of large armies. If you were just to do the percentages of the size of the armies in this region, it's probably somewhere between 70 and 80%. And I could go country by country, but the point I'm making is that armies play a central role in this region because they defend borders, they protect their territorial integrity, and they protect and defend their national sovereignty. And history has indicated time and time again that a lot of fighting has happened out here on land. Now, obviously, there's a lot going on in the other domains, but we are a critical and central part of the joint force. U.S. Army of the Pacific, I often refer to as it provides foundational capabilities at scale and at echelon that no other service provides. Army, what we call Army support to other services and executive directorships that we have for the joint force, they're greater than all the other services and DLA combined. We assure and deter. We assure our allies and partners by operating with them, and we deter by being forward in the region. The threats that emanate out here, they are in North Korea, they're from China, they're from Russia, they're from violent extremism. And so there is absolutely a multi-directional, all-domain series of threats that are trying to undermine a safe, stable, and secure region. And the Army plays a central role in being able to defend and enable our allies and partners in the region to protect their populations, to defend their national sovereignty, and defend their territorial integrity. Again, the region is often defined as an air and maritime region, but the actual capabilities that are in these countries are largely anchored around their armies. And that army-to-army relationship that we foster, build, maintain, care for, and create this sense of unity and collective commitment is actually done through the relationships that we have army to army, and I'll go into some detail on the depth of those relationships and sort maybe how we do that. That is such an important aspect of the security architecture that binds this region together, which is, in my view, land power and the land power network across the region.
Well, let me ask you then, you used words like assure and deter, which sort of exist principally at kind of one part of the competition continuum. You also use the word defend, which is, you know, I guess is a requirement that arises at another point on the competition continuum. How do you balance the requirements of those two different things, different activities? One, performing the sorts of things that contribute to U.S. overall efforts in the context of strategic competition, and two, also building readiness, preparing and training for a conflict should one break out.
Let me mention these four strategic roles for the joint force that we play. So we shape the operational environment, and we have to do that day in and day out on that competition continuum. We counter aggression on land in competition, but we also do that to prevent crisis or conflict. And we do that by assuring our allies and partners in the region because they have confidence in us and we have confidence in them. And that is, you know, part of that interoperability that's created. And then from a position of advantage, we have to be able to prevail during a large-scale operation, whether that's a crisis large-scale operation or whether that's a large-scale conflict or war. And then the fourth part of that would be to consolidate gains. I think we consolidate gains while we're in competition, but we would also have to consolidate gains in a crisis and, of course, in conflict or war, because that's essentially how it ends, and some political arbitration is going to be done at the end of that. I think the other thing is, you know, kind of answering the question of, like, why do we campaign? We campaign out here to deny key terrain, physical and human terrain, to our opponents. And they are working every day to seize terrain. because from that terrain, they can control people. And I think that that is essentially what Xi Jinping is saying about what's happening, you know, with Taiwan. I mean, it is about subjugating that back under China. I mean, he said that publicly. And then the second thing we do is we build. We build a coalition. We build combinations. We do that through rotational, dynamic, and permanent presence. We build unity. We build collective commitment. We build interior lines. So we gain positional advantage forward. We do that from the land so we can create operational endurance and staying power, so that our interoperability with our allies and partners is improved. And that interoperability has three forms. There's human interoperability, there's procedural interoperability, and there's technical interoperability. I can go into some of the details of that. And then going to the last point is, this is how we assure our allies and partners and the region that they can be confident in us, we can be confident in them. We're going to come to the aid of our treaty obligations, and then we are also going to ensure that partners in the region, albeit they may not be a treaty ally, partners are also going to be protected because they reside geographically on the periphery of almost all of our allies out here. And so their safety and security is also important. And obviously, you know, the region's safety and security is vital, not just to this particular theater, but to the globe, to the world.
The U.S. Joint Force doesn't enjoy the same alliance infrastructure that it has in Europe, for example, which brings with it presumably some challenges, but also perhaps some opportunities as you work to establish relationships, to establish partnerships. How do you go about doing that, building and strengthening, you know, those bilateral, trilateral, multilateral relationships in a region that is not defined by that alliance infrastructure?
Great question. So it is a challenge, but this is why the work out here is so important for armies. So really, 4 points I'm going to make. The first point is, and I mentioned it earlier, this land power network is very real out here. And the land power network consists of the army-to-army relationships. And as you could see, you know, percentage-wise, about 7 out of 10 of the CHODs out here, the chiefs of defense or their chairman equivalents, are army generals. So armies have a substantial influence in each of these armies. And as I said, by way of percentages, if you go like the Indian Army is 80% of the Indian military. 70% of the Philippine military is the Army. They have 12 divisions. They actually have more divisions than we have. You know, 75 to 80% of the Thailand's military is Army. 75% of Indonesia, Army. 65% of the Japanese military is Army. The point I'm making is that land power network is very real out here, and those relationships are vital to keeping that network as tight as possible so we can share, we can learn, we can grow, we can develop and help one another. And that is a major, major aspect of that assurance, I'll say, umbrella that we can create out here. Interoperability. So let me give you, I mentioned human, technical, and procedural. So let me walk through each of those. So some technical interoperability is when we have, say, a foreign military sale, right? So then we have a technical interoperability advantage because, you know, they use Javelins or 777s or Apaches or M1 tanks or watercraft or Patriots or HIMARS. You pick a system. Then there's a technical interoperability advantage that we gain from the land. And I could go into a whole host of other systems. Okay, from the technical interoperability that you get from systems, you then are enabled or you enhance your procedural interoperability, right? Calls for fire, planning, medevac, command and control. I mean, I could just go through a litany or a chorus of the ways that technical interoperability enhances our procedural interoperability, okay? And then the third type of interoperability is human interoperability. And I'm going to go back to the land power network. The technical and procedural interoperability is actually only improved exponentially when you have the human interoperability. And I will just tell you, because I can give you a quick story. A couple of years ago, I was in Thailand, and there were mortar crews working together, and we have in mortar crews, we have this, what's called a mortar ballistic computer. Well, the computer didn't make it over. In fact, the U.S. mortars didn't make it over. All they had was Thai mortars, Thai sights, Thai base plates, and a plotting board. And none of them spoke the same language. You know, there were Thai crews speaking Thai, and there were U.S. crews speaking English. And they had a Texas Instruments handheld computer that they were doing their computations on, and none of these guys shared the same language, but what the language that they did speak was mortarmen. They were mortarmen together, and so they knew the procedures, even though they didn't have to speak the language. And to me, that's a very good example of human interoperability that is a result of technical and procedural interoperability. And again, this is a part of what the land power network brings to the fight. On interoperability, I'll also say, you know, when we get a depth of, I'll say, platforms or capability exchanges like we have in Australia now, right? So Australia has M1 tanks. They're getting ready to buy HIMARS. They have UH-60 Blackhawks. They have Apaches. They're considering buying Patriots. I mean, these kinds of systems, platforms that we have with one another, in a case like Australia, they have essentially made a decision to buy the combined arms ground maneuver capabilities of the U.S., and therefore you're almost at a point with them where it's interchangeability, okay? Let me give you an example of that. We had M1 tanks down there last year for Talisman Sabre, and they had M1 tanks. Of course, they had more of them because we only shipped about 12 of them down there. We had a couple of them go down, and if it were not for the M1 tanks that were in Australia, we would have had to get parts in from the States. Instead, we used their depot level maintenance and their parts, and we're back up and operating, you know, within hours. So, I mean, there's a really good example of interoperability can give you almost elevated to interchangeability when you have these systems together. Let me make another comment where these opportunities are improved. So you're aware of the individual military education and training. So it's basically our schoolhouses, okay? This is a State Department-led program that is done in partnership with the DOD. Okay, 65% of all the seats in the IMET inventory for the Department of Defense are Army seats. So that really is proven ground out here in the Indo-Pacific because the armies are large. And so having them go to our courses, like basic officer course, mortar courses, artillery courses, aviation course, you know, I could pick them all out. Intel, etc., Command and General Staff College, the Army War College. We have inducted like either 4 or 5 chiefs of Army or chiefs of defense in just the last year that are graduates of the Command and General Staff College or the Army War College from the region. So these are now chiefs of defense or chiefs of Army. The point I'm making here is that that education advantage is another means by which we gain assurance in the region because, again, the land power network improves that. And again, I'm going to go back to, you know, the great capacity that the U.S. Army provides. Again, we're about 65% of all of the DOD seats. And then, you know, I kind of touched on it a little bit here, but I think Army leaders throughout the region, I have spent a lot of time talking about, you know, chiefs of Army and chiefs of defense. But the reality of it is those folks came up through the ranks and they're now in positions that we've had relationships with them over years, right? So let me give you one example in my case. When I was the 25th Division Commander, in 2014, the chief of the army was then Lieutenant General Agnew. Today, Lieutenant General retired Agnew is the National Security Advisor in the Philippines. And I could go into other, you know, relationships that we have here, but these are all born out of the land power network because of the army to army relationships that are so critical, so vital. And again, they are the security architecture that bind this region together. But when you look on the map and you see a lot of blue, people think first about the maritime and the air domains because of the distances and the color of the map. But the reality of it is, humans have this unique tendency to live on land. Decisions are made on land. Nations exist and their wealth exists on land, and the land has to be protected. Why? Because their people live there and we help them do that.
I like the way that you described it, that you know, that this is not just a maritime or air environment, it's a joint environment. So I want to ask you about jointness. We talk a lot about it in the U.S. military, about the imperative for jointness. Is that imperative stronger in a region like the Indo-Pacific than it might be elsewhere? And if so, how far down does that imperative go? Are small units, you know, down to say even the company level, operating jointly in ways that they might not be elsewhere?
Yeah, I'm going to talk first about the training center that we have built out here. And since you brought Europe up in the beginning of the conversation, for more than 50 years, we've had a training center on the continent of Europe at Graf and Hohenfels. And that is actually proving to be invaluable right now with the fight that's going on in Ukraine. Since before I came in the Army, so for more than 40 years, we've had training centers, two of them in the continental United States. But not until late 2021-22 did we have a training center out here in the Pacific, but we have one now. And there's three legs to it. There's a Hawaii campus here in an 8-island archipelago, tropic jungle, surrounded by joint forces. Let's refer to it as the third island chain, so to speak. And then just to the north, at the, around the Yukon and Donley training areas, which are basically between our Fort Wainwright and Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson. Again, surrounded by joint assets up there. That's mostly air and land, but you have space, soft, etc. And we have a third leg to this, which is called an exportable version. So we call it JPMRC-X, the Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center, exportable, of which in 21 and 22, we brought it into Indonesia. 23, we bought it into Talisman Sabre. And next month, actually later this month, it's going to go into the Philippines for Salakanib and Balikatan. So three legs to this. And to your question, like, our jointness is only going to improve, and it will improve exponentially if tactical leaders are able to be given an opportunity to bring their capabilities together in a training environment so that they can learn, grow, succeed, fail, you know, make mistakes, and be able to exercise and experiment all at the same time. And we are now doing that here in Hawaii and in Alaska. And if you think about it, Hawaii and Alaska, the environment and the conditions of these two training campuses best reflect the region. 8-island archipelago here in Hawaii looks a lot like Southeast Asia. The high altitude, extreme cold weather, mountainous part up in the Yukon Donley training areas in Alaska, that looks a lot like along the line of actual control in the Himalayas. It looks a lot like Korea. It looks like a lot like Hokkaido. It looks a lot like Mongolia. Anyways, the point I'm making is we need to train as a joint force to regain the strength of our jointness at the tactical level as well. It can't just be simulation and computer exercises at, you know, my level and the three-star level where you're doing like a command post exercise. It's got to be real ships, real planes, real soldiers, real units moving in real time, being opposed by an opponent who's trying to beat them in a real world scenario with an outside set of eyes to give you feedback on what you're doing well and what you're not doing well. So in my view, I think one of the real untold stories that is invaluable to your question is that the Army, U.S. Army, and U.S. Army Pacific has created the Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center. It's got a Hawaii campus and Alaska campus, got an exportable version, and it is tied into what's called PMTEC, or the Pacific Multinational Training and Experimentation Capability at U.S. Indo-PACOM. So we are pulling together, the region by having these countries come together at these training campuses that best replicate the environment and the conditions that we are most likely to face day to day in competition or in crisis or in conflict. And another element of this is this has a live virtual and constructive simulation feed. So, for example, last year, we put the, we'll call them, we had these towers, these simulation and virtual towers that pushed, I'll say, X's and O's for a battle simulation feed from Hawaii into Alaska. Well, we have done the same thing into Korea. We've done the same thing into Japan because of the mission training complexes we had last year. But last year, that successful link occurred, so we now have a simulation wrap, so we can put live forces in the field. We can have a virtual opponent at echelon, and then we have a constructive environment for all of us to learn and grow. And so now we can do multi-echelon training with live, virtual, and constructive simulation all being brought together. So it's a very exciting capability that is now in place out in the Pacific, and you know, really few people understand what that has meant to the region and to the command. One last point, I think, John, on this that I think is important. I mentioned the 2 years we had it in Indonesia. The last year we had it in Australia for Talisman Sabre. This year it's in the Philippines. And then in the coming years, we're going to continue to put this into countries that have asked for it. That's the important part. The countries are asking for it. Why? Because they have been to our schools, they have been to our training centers, and they see the value of a collective combat training center that improves the proficiency of their own forces for their concept of operations and for what they intend to achieve with their forces. Let me give you an example. The Philippine military, particularly the Army, is transitioning to what's called territorial defense operations. We are bringing that training center into the Philippines this year with their invitation and by their consent. Why? Because they're trying to find out and learning through us, because again, they've been to our schools and they've been to our training centers. How can we set up a collective training center to evaluate and assess our units? Let me tell you what that training center looks like. There's really three important parts of a combat training center, to include ours. The first part is you need a free-thinking enemy. You need somebody who's opposing you and trying to beat you. The second part is you need a real-world scenario that's complex enough to test you and your unit, which stresses your unit because that scenario is giving you changes that you do not anticipate. And so it makes you think and work and react and respond and fight your plan, but also have to come up with contingencies because your enemy, again, is trying to beat you. And then the third important part of these combat training centers is you need an outside set of eyes to evaluate you, to assess you. If you're assessing yourself, you're not going to be as hard. You need an outside set of eyes, a group of what we call observer controllers, to say, hey, this is what you're doing well, but this is what you are not doing well, and you need to work on these things to get better.
You mentioned that the exportable version of this training center will be in the Philippines very shortly for a couple of exercises. One of those exercises, or at least one of them, involves the deployment of the mid-range capability. I was speaking, I believe it was last week, with Lieutenant Colonel Ben Blaine, the commander of the Long Range Precision Fires Battalion in the 1st Multi-Domain Task Force, and he kind of impressed upon me what a big deal that deployment is. The MRC, the mid-range capability, is a medium-range missile launcher, but it's an extraordinarily versatile one. Unlike anything really, anything else in the Army inventory. Can you talk a little bit about why it's so significant that the system is being deployed into the Indo-Pacific region for the first time?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing I'd say is what's not well understood is that I'm really thankful to the Philippine military and the Philippine civilian leaders who, again, that system is in the Philippines as part of a joint training exercise that we are doing with them, Balikatan and Salakanib. And so it's operating there at their invitation and with their consent. That would be my first point. Again, to highlight the fact that what we've been talking about is the land power network. But let me back up a little bit in time. I'm going to go back to my time out here as a major general. In a LANPAC conference that we do annually here in Honolulu, where the region's armies come together, Admiral Harry Harris, then the Indo-PACOM commander at the time, in his remarks made a comment and said, "The Army's got to be able to sink ships, neutralize satellites, shoot down missiles, and deny the enemy the ability to command and control." I think what's interesting is at the time, because I was in the audience listening, I knew that we could neutralize satellites then. I knew that we could shoot down missiles and then deny the enemy the ability to command and control. We could do that then. We could do that today. The thing that we could not do then that we can do today is sink ships. And that's the value of having the MRC, John, in the Philippines, because we now have that capability forward and we can, in fact, sink ships. So the four taskers, if you will, they gave us then, we were already working on what was called multi-domain battle. In our gap study in the U.S. Army, we were looking at what systems we needed to modernize and bring to the force. We were also, importantly, looking at what were the new organizations that we needed to bring to the force. Because I was the deputy commander in this command at the time, we were already looking at what is the organization of the multi-domain task force. In fact, not too far from where I'm sitting, we were had a compartmented planning bay to pull all that together. So his remarks at the time were just an accelerant to us on our new concept that we were working, which at the time was multi-domain battle. Now it's turned into multi-domain operations. At the time, we didn't have an organization, but now we do. And that is the multi-domain task force, of which Ben is part of. So then I'm going to jump forward to when I was at G357 in the Army. And in late 2019, 2020, then Secretary of the Army McCarthy said, "Hey, we need to stand up this multi-domain task force. And where should we stand it up at?" And we stood it up at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And it was the first multi-domain task force. And it was an experimental organization. And this is 2020. Now, it's 2024. And I am very proud of that story, because that's basically a combatant commander putting the gauntlet down saying, "I need the Army to do these things from the land." The Army was already working on the organization and the capabilities, and here we are 4 years later with those capabilities involved in a joint exercise in the first island chain. And I think that that's a very, that's a great story of how rapid and quickly we can get a maritime strike Tomahawk land-based anti-ship capability into the multi-domain task force and in a joint exercise. Now, that's been a lot of hard work over the last 5 years. I can tell you for the nearly three that I've been out here, it's been extraordinary to watch what the leaders and soldiers have been able to do. It's also been remarkable to watch the Army work on these systems and get them in place and put them in the hands of our operators so we can actually have it forward in the region right now, doing its mission in support of the joint force and in support of our treaty ally, the Armed Forces of the Philippines.
I want to ask you about, you know, I told your team when I got in touch to ask if we could invite you on the podcast that at MWI, we've seen a pretty significant increase in submissions on topics related to the Indo-Pacific AOR, and a lot of them were coming from the operational force. On multiple occasions, as I was working with those authors to sort of refine their articles, you know, through the throughout the editorial process, I'd ask about a particular phrase or about the way that an idea was worded, and frequently they'd say, "Oh, that's something I've heard General Flynn talking about." An example of that was, again, working with Ben Blaine on an article he wrote for us that used the phrase transform in contact or transformation in contact. And he told me that it's something he's heard both you and General George, the Chief of Staff of the Army, he's heard both of you use that phrase when they talk about the Army in the Indo-Pacific region. I'm wondering if you can kind of describe what you mean by transformation in contact.
Yeah. So I'll back up. When I took command a couple of years ago, one of my initial threads of guidance to the command was every exercise will be an experiment, and every experiment needs to be an exercise. And the point I was making was we have to continually find opportunities to improve the way we're organized and to improve the way that we are improving our warfighting capabilities. And we have to do that in an operational environment, in training, forward in the region. It's sort of the story of JPMRC. To me, JPMRC is transforming in contact. We needed a training center out here for the joint force to improve our jointness, because we never had one. We had one in Europe, two in the continental United States. And guess what? This environment and these conditions that exist in Alaska and Hawaii, it looks just like the region. So General George recently, and I'm hugely in favor of this, because his transforming in contact is about doing this iteratively and continuously so that we can find ways to be leaner, more lethal, more mobile, lower signatures, and probably most importantly is create advantages for the joint force. Because the contributions that we make, again, are to improve the joint force, and we do that by dominating in the land and the interdependencies that come together from the land into all the domains is a huge advantage of what I believe he's trying to achieve, not just across the Army, but in my particular part of the Army out here. I think his approach on integrating technologies faster, pushing new and more cost-effective techniques and technologies into our operational units just as soon as we possibly can, that's a very, very useful framework. Of course, you know, we have Operation Pathways out here, John, so we have this opportunity to be constantly iterating, developing, learning, succeeding, failing, and providing that input back to the institution so they can make improvements on the systems that we're doing. There's a lot of discussion, of course, on the use of our own UAVs, and then there's a lot of discussion on countering those UAVs. Of course, that's a lot of that is coming out of the Ukraine-Russian fight, but of course, those things matter out here as well, substantially. I mean, and from the land, you can do things in particular geographical locations where you can do sea control, sea denial, and we need to be able to do that out here in this region. I hope that is a way to be able to express what transforming in contact is. Again, I think our chief has that exactly right, and we need to continue to do that. And I think, you know, if I take his intent of I want you to transform and contact, and I need you to do that with organizations, capabilities, and technologies. My way of expressing that to at the operational level down to tactical units is every exercise is an experiment, and every experiment is an exercise. And we will spiral in new organizations, new technologies, new capabilities so we can improve our concepts and our warfighting advantages as a result of transforming iteratively and constantly.
You know, I hesitate to draw too many comparisons with Europe because it is so fundamentally different. But one of the things that we've realized in the past handful of years, maybe it was, you know, in 2016, there was this now quite famous RAND war game that concluded that if Russia were to launch an attack against the Baltics, the Russian forces could be in the Baltic capitals within, I think it was 60 hours. And there was this realization that, you know, the sort of long-term physical U.S. military presence in Europe that was quite consolidated, mainly in Germany, was not necessarily... that it needed to change. We needed to have a presence elsewhere. And so our forward posture changed. Has that also been happening in the Indo-Pacific region where, you know, for a long time, it was tens of thousands of U.S. service members in South Korea and in Japan, and then, you know, maybe temporary presences of U.S. forces elsewhere for occasional exercises. Are we changing the way we're thinking about forward posture in the Indo-Pacific?
Yeah, so this is a great opportunity to talk about operation pathways. So pathways, operation pathways, and again, I was out here as a two-star with Pacific Pathways when, you know, a couple of predecessors before me, General Brooks, we were trying to, at the time, be in three countries over 3 months west of the international dateline, and I would say it was sort of, you know, Pacific Pathways 1.0. What we're doing now, John, is what I refer to as Operation Pathways. And Operation Pathways is our operational approach to campaigning in the theater. It is adversary-focused, and it is concentrated on improving our posture, capabilities, messaging, and will, our ability to integrate deterrence in the region in support of our allies and partners. And Operation Pathways is the very definition of campaigning. That definition is the logical and sequential arrangement of operations, activities, investments that support U.S. national security objectives and those of our allies and partners. And so Operation Pathways represents the more than 40 joint and army-to-army exercises that we do throughout the year, and we are doing the logical and sequential arrangement of those OAIs, as we call, to do really three things. We are trying to increase the interoperability of our allies and partners and the confidence of them. We're trying to increase the readiness of the joint force by training as a joint force, and we are trying to deny key terrain, both human and physical, to our adversaries. We're preventing their insidious and incremental and irresponsible behavior of infecting the rest of the region. And so the end state of this is the creation of the third way that we're going about our business out here. So we have JPMRC as our first way, Operation Pathways is our second way. The third way is the creation of joint interior lines. And joint interior lines is positional advantage. What is positional advantage? It is the physical act of permanent, rotational, or dynamic employment of forces that builds operational endurance, it builds positional advantage, and it creates operational reach and staying power for the joint force. And that staying power results in the foundational capabilities that only the Army provides at echelon and at scale to the joint force. What are those foundational capabilities? That is command and control. That is protection by way of integrated air and missile defense, mobility, counter-mobility, and survivability for engineering and medical. The third is collection. We do collection from the ground. And we have to have a terrestrial-based layer of collection, humans involved. And then the final one, and really important, is sustainment. We have to have the logistical architecture. We have to have the material, the maintenance, the resupply at scale, at depth, distributed throughout the region in all classes of supply in support of our allies and partners. And again, that's what the Army provides the joint force at scale and at echelon. You may not realize this, John. In Hawaii alone, there are 10 flag officer headquarters that do all those enabling commands. You know, one final comment on this, and this is often misunderstood. U.S. Army Pacific assigned forces and those that come in on rotation, on any given day, we are 60 to 65% of the size of the U.S. Marine Corps total. I mean, this is by two times the largest theater army in the Army. So about 20 to 25% on any given day is actually operating for U.S. Army Pacific in either an assigned or a rotational capacity out here. Again, that is something that most people don't fully comprehend. They don't understand that, but that's the fact.
Well, that, you know, that I think it leads perfectly into what will probably be kind of a final question I'd like to ask you. Our listenership is fairly broad and fairly diverse. I think in some ways it kind of reflects the diversity of the stakeholders in the Indo-Pacific region. We've got Army listeners, we've got joint listeners from other U.S. services, we've got listeners from across the U.S. defense enterprise, but we also have a lot of listeners from allied and partner nations. Are there any specific things, you know, with that kind of broad audience in mind, are there any specific things that maybe aren't well understood about the Indo-Pacific region, about U.S. Army Pacific in particular and its role in the region? Are there anything that you can kind of share, anything that maybe people would benefit by sort of having a better understanding of?
Probably our history. You know, I think that there's this notion out there, or maybe misunderstanding, that the wars out here have been fought primarily by the Navy and the Marine Corps, and that's just patently false. You know, there was an enormous contribution by the U.S. Army out here during the Second World War. There was an enormous contribution by the Army out here during the Korean War. And again, in the Vietnam War. And, you know, I recognize that nobody wants a war out here. I certainly don't. But I think the fact of the matter is that in many ways, we have ceded our history. And I'm being a little self-critical in my own service because many of us don't fully understand it. And I think that, you know, we have more campaign streamers in the U.S. Army on our colors, on the Army colors in this theater than all other theaters or all other wars combined. And I think that our history out here is important to reflect upon because of what it means today. We are a Pacific power. We are a Pacific nation. And the Army has an enormously important role in the Pacific in stabilizing, securing, and creating a safe and open environment out here for the global commons and for the people to feel protected. And we are a part of the joint force. You know, I was just thinking recently about the Korean War and the role that we played there. And I'll just say this way, you know, there was a period of time there in mid-51 where Seoul actually changed hands four times. And then it ended in an armistice, which is basically there's a pause in the war. And it ended on the 38th parallel. And we could talk about all the reasons why it ended, but what I guess the important point is this. In 1953, when that ended, if you look at where we are today in 2024, South Korea, we have a combined force with that. At the four-star level, at the three-star level, at the two-star level. So Division, Field Army, and USFK, those are combined forces. They are essentially one. And South Korea is the 10th wealthiest economy in the world. 10th wealthiest economy in the world. So One could say, well, that was tragic in the 50s, and it was. But another may say today, look what that produced. It produced a free country. It produced the 10th wealthiest country in the world. It produced a combined relationship that we have today that is a stabilizing factor, not just in Korea, but really in the region and across the globe. And so this is what your army, your U.S. Army, has meant to this region for more than a century. And understanding our role out here today requires us to reflect on yesterday and look back and see the value of what the Army produced and what the Army meant for the joint force in its ability to protect and project U.S. power into the region in support of our allies and partners and in support of the region and in support of a safe, secure, and free environment.
Well, sir, I think we will leave it there. I want to thank you again for making some time and joining me for this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thank you, John.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing before you go. If you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.